Our final case of the morning is number 11116, Mary E. Harris versus Public Health Trust of Miami-Dade County. We have Mr. Nix arguing for the appellant. You may begin when you're ready. I see you've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Noah Nix on behalf of Mary Ellen Harris. Ms. Harris's supervisor, Ms. Carino, told Ms. Harris to her face that blacks are lazy, that they don't like to work, and that that is why she doesn't hire any. The question today is simply whether those statements can create a hostile work environment. This court has already answered that question, and the answer is yes.
So you don't, just so I'm clear, you're not like walking away from your non-hostile work environment claims today. You're just focusing on your hostile work environment claim.
Correct, Your Honor, and I plan to address the disparate treatment claim as well as the retaliation claim, should we have time. So the 11th Circuit has listed racist statements which, in its words, are, quote, sufficiently severe to create a hostile work environment. Among the statements in that list was the statement, quote, black men are lazy, which is no different than the statement we have in this case. And so that's the law in this circuit, and the district court simply got it wrong.
And do you have any cases where there was only one such comment and that was held to create a hostile work environment?
No, Your Honor. However, in Smelter versus Southern Home Care Services, this court rejected the argument, the defendant's argument, that a one-time use of the N-word could not create a hostile work environment. And while the statement we have in this case is not the N-word, we have its functional equivalent. Laziness was the primary justification for hundreds of years of slavery and subsequent second-class citizenship in the Jim Crow era. And the N-word itself is in fact offensive because it relies on those notions in that history. And in an era where the N-word is becoming increasingly inappropriate to use, the stereotypes which underlie the N-word are what people rely on, namely laziness. And the important thing to keep in mind here is we're looking at this from the perspective of an African-American employee, and the effect on that listener is no different. It conjures up the same deeply hurtful sentiments that the N-word does. And so this court's line in Smelter, where it says that it strongly disagrees that a one-time use of the N-word can create a hostile work environment, is helpful to us here. The Fifth Circuit has also recently found, just last year, in Woods versus Cantrell, citing then-Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit, that a one-time use of the N-word is, again, sufficient to create a hostile work environment. And the district court erred then by finding that this was not repeated in sum or substance, and because of that, it somehow mitigated its severity. A reasonable juror could look at this and find that when you say these blatantly racist things that ascribe a negative workplace attribute to someone solely based on the color of their skin, that immediately marks the beginning of a hostile work environment. And so this court allows you to establish a hostile work environment through two avenues. The one I focused on so far is the severity prong, but you can also show a hostile work environment through pervasiveness. And to the extent that this court would disagree that a one-time use of racism can create a hostile work environment, we've also got the pervasive argument, and the district court didn't address it appropriately. So Ms. Harris testified that after reporting these statements and after her supervisor found out that she's not Hispanic but that she is African-American, her entire demeanor changes. They once spoke Spanish together frequently. Then Ms. Harris testified that they had a loving, caring relationship. And as soon as she says, no, I'm not Panamanian, I'm not Dominican, I'm black, Ms. Carino immediately becomes hostile towards her. She stalks her around the office. she effectively demotes her by denying her access to the supply closet to do her job. And Ms. Harris alleges or testifies that this occurred daily. And the district court dismissed both the following and the denial of the access to the supply closet on single bases. So there are four factors that this court looks at when it's looking to whether something is pervasive or not.
Can I do a quick question? I recognize that you've got several sort of workplace events that you say sort of collectively constitute the pervasive conduct. And I don't expect that we will have the need or the time to go through them one by one. But like, so for instance, you mentioned the supply closet. What's the evidence though that the exclusion from the supply closet was based on race, as it still has to be, even for a hostile work environment claim?
Sure. Judge Newsom, the evidence is the statement itself. So Ms. Carino said—
I'm sorry, the statement that you don't go to the supply closet anymore, or the blacks are lazy statement?
The blacks are lazy statement.
And how much time elapsed between the statement and the ban?
According to Ms. Harris's testimony, we don't have an exact date, but it was shortly thereafter. And we know at least it was before January of 2016, which would have been 4 months. During January 2016, we know that the Public Health Trust lawyer was then involved, so we'd assume that she has sort of reported this behavior before then, before it could get to that stage. So
it— Do you know if Ms. Carino was ever disciplined by the hospital or the company?
She wasn't. And in fact, Ms. Nieves, when Ms. Harris complained about Ms. Carino's actions, defended Ms. Carino. She said, Ms. Carino's not like that, and she wouldn't say something like that. That's all we have here. And Ms. Harris complained three other times to three other different supervisors, and she was ignored. She was told, go back to work. And then Ms. Carino was even defended. And that adds to the hostility of this environment, because as Ms. Harris testified, she felt voiceless. And one of the factors we look at for pervasiveness is whether the conduct was humiliating. It is indeed humiliating to complain to four different of your supervisors and to be ignored and to have your claims dismissed. Meanwhile, your supervisor, an avowed racist, continues to harass you every single day. Everywhere you look, you're confronted with her racism. And returning back to Judge Newsom's question, I don't think I got around to answering it. The connection between the state or the evidence that the post-statement treatment was based on race comes from the statement itself. Ms. Carino testified that she thought that blacks are lazy, and her subsequent actions are consistent with that. She's following Ms. Harris around to make sure, presumably, that she's doing her job, because she doesn't think she's going to, because she thinks blacks are lazy. And also, it's important to note here, we're at the summary judgment stage, where all inferences are drawn in favor of the non-moving party, that would be Ms. Harris, and all facts are construed in a light most favorable to her. And it's not a stretch or even an inference to begin with to say that someone who is an avowed racist the very next day is still a racist and she's acting on that racism. And the final point to your question is the sharp uptick and change in behavior. If it's not clear from the briefs, Ms. Carino thought that Ms. Harris was Hispanic because they always spoke Spanish together. And as soon as she found out that that's not the case, her treatment of Ms. Harris flips. And so that's the connection to the conduct, or that shows that the conduct afterwards was based on Ms. Harris's race. So
it's the sort of thing that we would expect comparative evidence for, like Ms. Harris was not granted access to the supply closet and these other people were. She was followed around the office and these other people weren't, or something like that. Is that the sort of evidence that we would expect in a situation like this? As a way of proving because of race, if that makes sense?
Sure. Judge Newsom, the answer is that it's relevant for our other claims, the district treatment claim, but for a hostile work environment claim, there's no requirement that we need a comparator. And really, again, at the summary judgment stage, we've got testimony from Ms. Harris. And in cases like Smelter, testimony was all that this court has had. But when we take it for face value, which the court should do at summary judgment, she has raised enough to establish a hostile work environment. Because when we look at the totality of the circumstances, and when we look at this from the perspective of an African-American employee, a reasonable juror could find that these statements created a hostile work environment.
The reason I ask is just because it's like Title VII defines a hostile work environment claim, in effect, as a subset of a disparate impact claim, like statutorily, sort of like just structurally, it's kind of shuffled in there with disparate treatment claims, I'm sorry. And so both have to be because of race, and it's just a little weird that on the disparate treatment side, we've sort of constructed this superstructure of McDonnell Douglas and everything with comparators, and on the hostile work environment claim, which is in effect just a variant of the same claim, we sort of don't do that. And I was just curious about why it is that we would do it in one case but not the other, and why we wouldn't expect the two claims to sort of proceed roughly the same way.
Sure, and I think one possible way to look at this is that under the disparate treatment claim, even in this case, we don't need comparative evidence because we're proceeding under a direct evidence theory. And there, this court has said if you're proceeding under direct evidence, there's no need to go through the McDonnell Douglas burden shifting analysis. And so I think the hostile work environment is more akin to direct evidence and circumstantial evidence because we're showing, based on these statements, that's directly, establishing this hostile work environment.
I wonder, I know you're running out of time, so you'll be on our time. I wonder if maybe one reason that Judge Newsom is kind of curious about this comparator evidence is that obviously the record also has a fairly significant number of disciplinary issues related to your client that are not related to Ms. Carino. And I mean, why wouldn't that suggest pretty strongly that whatever micromanaging or different things like that were a result of some of the work-related issues rather than racial discrimination?
Sure. So, Judge Grant, I'd say that, again, in at least the hostile work environment cases that I've looked at, there's not an analysis, or one of the elements isn't whether or not the defendant could somehow justify how it was treating the plaintiff based on, disciplinary actions or their conduct. And I'd point, too, to the fact that the statements, blacks are lazy, they don't like to work, and that's why I don't hire any, that has nothing to do with her discipline or any comparators at all. If this court were to look to those things, it would only be relevant for the post-statement treatment, which I think the statement itself, the fact that Ms. Harris reported that statement, and the sharp change in behavior, I think that's, drawing inferences in favor of Ms. Harris, I think that's enough to show, she wasn't disciplined for a year prior to this, and then all of a sudden she is. But again, I don't think it's relevant at all to the statements that were made and the fact that those are sufficiently severe, being that they're overtly racist, to create a hostile work environment.
Thank you. We'll give you your full time for rebuttal since you are answering the court's questions. Mr. Candela?
Morning. Bill Candela, Assistant County Attorney on behalf of the Public Health Trust. The plaintiff didn't establish a prima facie case of a hostile work environment because this is a one slur over 16-month case. So that's the, when you analyze this one slur over 16-month, the 11th Circuit has been clear in a number of cases that I'd like to point to in my brief that this one slur over 16-month is insufficient to establish a hostile work environment. And it starts with Barrow, and then McCann versus Tillman, Latrice, and Wallace House, and those are all at pages 24 of my brief, and that's the 11th Circuit has been very clear about that. You also have this alleged following around, and in the next page of my brief, I cite to the cases that talk about the fact that following a coworker around by a supervisor is also insufficient to establish a prima facie case of a hostile work environment. This is particularly true here because there's nothing to indicate that the following around was premised on race. Or
that'd be a pretty horrible thing to hear, though, right? You're talking with someone who you, at work who you think is your colleague, and certainly you, certainly their colleague, and you think they're your friend, and then they say something outrageous like that, and then nothing is done, as far as I can tell, from the record to discipline that person. Might you think that you're being followed around because of racism at that point?
Well, that might be a subjective view. And while it is undoubtedly boorish behavior, following them around, an employee around for whatever reason it would be, it really doesn't rise to the level of a hostile work environment. And in support of that pretty simple premise, we cited Davis versus United States Postmaster. That's a 2006 case in Mendoza versus Borden that you're familiar with. And all of those cases say just that. When you have these kind of sporadic events, you have the statement, and then you may have some following that wasn't related to anything. And then there was another instance where the employee, the plaintiff complained that Ms. Carreño, the supervisor, had poked her from behind. And as the district court pointed out, there's nothing to tie that, and the plaintiff didn't do that. I want to emphasize that, didn't do that below. There was nothing to tie that to the employee's race. And that's the emphasis in the district court's opinion, and that's what I want to emphasize here. There's absolutely nothing.
Let me ask you this. So yes. Speaking only for myself, I don't know what my colleagues think about this. I think the district court may have erred in declining to consider the events that it considered to be time-barred as part of the hostile work environment claim. If that was an error, do we have to reverse?
No, Your Honor. No, you do not have to reverse because, first of all, let's for a second, and I don't believe that was raised below because that argument wasn't raised below. The fact that it should be considered background. When you look at their response, they never address that, and they never make that argument. But be that as it may, in answer to your question, it isn't background evidence that is any way relevant because those events that happened at that other hospital, Jackson North, right, those are the events that happened in 2014 and before that, before the employee was transferred to Jefferson Reeves. You have a different hospital with different supervisors and different types of events. But I want to stress, they're different supervisors, and it's a different hospital. Here, you have a brand new set of supervisors at Jefferson Reeves, and it's in a different hospital with different supervisors. So you don't have any connection that would in any way bring this background evidence and lead some credence to that, how this added to a hostile work environment. So to answer your question directly, absolutely not. It would have no bearing on the alleged hostile work environment that this employee suffered at Jefferson Reeves.
Was there any evidence in the record about why Ms. Harris was denied access to the supply closet or who had access?
Right. Only evidence is that at some point it was administrator, the administrator who said, we're going to implement this policy that certain people weren't going to be allowed to enter the medical supply room. But what is interesting here and what the district court below emphasized, and it's Administrator Freeman, she's the one that said something to the effect, nobody can enter the supply room. What the district court emphasized here below is that all she did was ask somebody else. She asked the supervisor, let me enter into the supply room. She was then able to enter into the supply room, and she went about her business. So there's nothing detrimental about the fact that she had to ask somebody else to get into the supply room to get the supplies. The point I'm trying to make is she was able to get the supplies, she was able to carry out her duties, and this is undisputed, that order of, hey, you need to ask somebody permission or authority to be authorized to get into the supply room had nothing to do with the employee's race. Absolutely nothing. It was just simply that. It was a mandate or a directive from Administrator Freeman, who's also African-American, that in order to get into the supply room, you're going to have to ask authorization from somebody else. And that's what she did. So that's, I think I've addressed that question. As to the supply room, briefly, there was some reference to the district treatment as to the disciplines involved here. And here was a 3-day suspension, a 5-day suspension, and ultimately a termination. And when you look at those disciplines, you're going to see that Carreño, right, the person who allegedly made that vulgar statement or the racist statement, she had nothing to do with those disciplines. She did not author the disciplinary action report for the 3-day, the 5-day, or the dismissal. She wasn't the decision maker as it relates to the 3-day, the 5-day, or the termination. Beyond that, when you look at those disciplines, they stand on their own, right? She was late. As to the 3-day suspension, she was absent. The plaintiff was absent a number of days, and it's reflected in the in our swipe-in, swipe-out system called Kronos. And as a result of that, she was disciplined for that. There's nothing race-related as it relates to that. Kronos does not discriminate. As to the 5-day suspension, it's as a result, it's because the plaintiff was rude to a pregnant patient who wanted to get a vaccine. And the pregnant patient went ahead and submitted a letter. She submitted a letter saying, I was treated very rudely by this nurse, and as a result of that, we had to come back a second day. That's why she got the 5-day suspension. And ultimately, the termination is because she called her supervisors in their chain of in the chain of command, she referred to them as bitches and wanted to get them fired. And that was reported by another nurse, a medical technician, Jean-Marie Francois. So all of those events had nothing to do with Ms. Carreño.
Do you think that if the statement had included the N-word, it would be enough to establish a pervasive hostile environment?
The 11th Circuit, I don't think, has dealt with that particular issue. We don't have that issue here. I think the answer to that question is no. And I say that because of the strength of the one slur cases that we've seen over the years from the 11th Circuit. So based on that hierarchy of cases, I think the answer would be no. Now,
other courts have recognized, I guess, that there's something just uniquely violent or damaging about that word, right?
And that might be the case, and that would be understandable. But we don't have that issue here, and the 11th Circuit hasn't ruled on that. So I don't have any, unless the court has any questions related to any of the other issues. I think I've addressed them in my brief. I will rest on my brief unless there's anything else, any other subject area of interest. Thank you very much. And with that, the Public Health Trust respectfully requests that the order granting summary judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
A few points on rebuttal. First, my friend on the other side attempts to take each and every one of the points that we discuss in our brief in a piecemeal fashion, but this court in Mendoza said to look at a hostile work environment claim based on the totality of the circumstances. He attacks the following and says that it's insufficient, and the district court did the same, and that was error. In Harris versus Forklift Systems, U.S. Supreme Court case, it said that no one factor is required under the hostile work environment claim. And in finding that the following, the district court simply disregarded the following solely because it said, oh, this is not threatening or humiliating. But again, that totally disregards another factor that this court looks at, which is the frequency. And in Smelter, it said where the plaintiff testified that on a daily basis they were harassed, that is pervasive harassment. And so by ignoring the frequency, this court violated Supreme Court precedent, and it didn't view this case appropriately, and my opposing counsel did the same thing during...
Just to be sure I understand, what is the frequency, what evidence is the frequency argument based on in this case?
It's based on Ms. Harris's testimony that the following occurred daily, as well as the denial of the supply clause. It was daily because she needed supplies to do her job every single day as a nurse. And also, opposing counsel said that there's no harm in the fact that she had to ask to get access to the supply closet. But there's two reasons why that's incorrect. The first is that it was colored by Ms. Carino's racist statement. And so every day that Ms. Harris had to go and ask someone else to open the supply closet, she's reminded of that racism. Reasonable juror could find that that's pervasive and hostile. The second reason is that the person who she had to request access from was technically her subordinate. So she's effectively been demoted and every day has to wait around on someone who is technically her subordinate. And again, that's humiliating and it's pervasive harassment. This court asked a lot about comparator evidence. And one point on that is we do have the testimony of Ms. Harris's coworker, Ms. Mells, who said that African-Americans were treated differently in this office. And so what we see is when Ms. Carino didn't think Ms. Harris was African-American, she's treated one way. As soon as she has reason to believe she is, she starts treating them, consistent with Ms. Mell's testimony, differently.
What were some specifics about Ms. Mell's testimony? Did she just make a general statement, or did she have specifics about the way people were treated differently?
She said that African-American employees were generally under more stress and that they had more required of them and that they were micromanaged. But beyond that, we don't have many specifics. Okay. And I'll close.
Good to address one thing before your time runs out, and if you go over, it's okay. But he got into the disparate treatment claim a little bit, and I just want to make sure you have an advantage, have an opportunity to respond. Can you, and I think in my mind, speaking only for myself, the toughest piece for you there is the fact that Carino was not the decision maker, Neves was, and so you've got somehow to impute Carino's ugliness to
sure.
Neves. But I mean, isn't it fairly clear that Neves did the required independent investigation here to kind of cut the causal chain, so to speak?
As to the termination, and even to the termination, we dispute that it cuts the causal chain because Ms. Nieves was the one who defended Ms. Carino, and she says multiple times that she relied on the recommendation of Ms. Freeman. Someone else we allege in our brief is taking a role in some of this. These discriminatory actions. But as to, it's important to note that it's not just the termination. We've got disciplinary action reports and 3-day suspensions, and both of which Ms. Harris testified that when she asked, why am I being disciplined, Ms. Freeman and Ms. Liss told her that this is under the direction of Ms. Carino. And this court in the Lampalas case found that the cat's paw theory can suffice under the disparate treatment cause of action.
I'm sorry, what was that case that you decided?
It's Lampalas versus Mini Circuits Lab, Inc.
Do you happen to have the site? I'm so sorry.
Sure, that's 163 F3D 1236 at 1249. And it stands for the proposition that if you act in accordance with a harasser's recommendation without further investigating yourself, and you simply rubber stamp that recommendation, then that can be sufficient to connect the harasser to the disciplinary action.
Do you recall where in the record the statements were that these disciplinary actions were taken on the recommendation of Ms. Carino?
Yes, Your Honor. It's 32.5 at 21 and 27. And again, on pages 31 and through 32, when Ms. Harris asked her coworkers, why am I being treated like this, they said, go talk to Gia, that is Ms. Carino. And
was that Ms. Harris's testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we'd ask this court to reverse as to all three of the grant of summary judgment as to all three of Ms. Harris's claims. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Nix, I know that you are a law student at the University of Georgia Law School, and you've done a very good job. Also, thank your professor, Professor Birch, over here as your supervising attorney.
Thank you.
Yeah, well
Excellent
done.
Job. Very well, well done. Done.